I am living at the Villa Borghese. There is not a crumb of dirt anywhere, nor a chair misplaced. We are all alone here, and we are dead. Last night, Boris discovered that he was lousy. I had to shave his armpits, and even then the itching did not stop. How can one get lousy in a beautiful place like this? But no matter. We might never have known each other so intimately, Boris and I, had it not been for the lice. Boris has just given me a summary of his views. He is a weather prophet. The weather will continue bad, he says. There will be more calamities, more death, more despair. Not the slightest indication of a change anywhere. The cancer of time is eating us away. Our heroes have killed themselves or are killing themselves. The hero, then, is not time, but timelessness. We must get in step, a lockstep, toward the prison of death. There is no escape. The weather will not change. It is now the fall of my second year in Paris. I was sent here for a reason I have not yet been able to fathom. I have no money, no resources, no hopes. I am the happiest man alive. A year ago, 6 months ago, I thought that I was an artist. I no longer think about it. I am. Everything that was literature has fallen from me. There are no more books to be written, thank God. This, then? This is not a book. This is libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the word. No, this is a prolonged insult, a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty. What you will. I am going to sing for you. A little off-key, perhaps, but I will sing. I will sing while you croak. I will dance over your dirty corpse. To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing. It is to you, Tanya, that I am singing. I wish that I could sing better, more melodiously, but then perhaps you would never have consented to listen to me. You have heard the others sing, and they have left you cold. They sang too beautifully, or not beautifully enough. It is the 20-something of October. I no longer keep track of the date. Would you say my dream of the 14th November last? There are intervals, but they are between dreams, and there is no consciousness of them left. The world around me is dissolving, leaving here and there spots of time. The world is a cancer eating itself away. I am thinking that when the great silence descends upon all and everywhere, music will at last triumph. When, into the womb of time, everything is again withdrawn, chaos will be restored. And chaos is the score upon which reality is written. You, Tanya, are my chaos. It is why I sing. It is not even I. It is the world dying, shedding the skin of time. I am still alive, kicking in your womb, a reality to write upon. Dozing off. The physiology of love. The whale with his 6-foot penis in repose. The bat, penis libre. Animals with a bone in the penis. Hence, a bone on. Happily, says Gourmand, the bony structure is lost in man. Happily? Yes, happily. Think of the human race walking around with a bone on. The kangaroo has a double penis, one for weekdays and one for holidays. Dozing. A letter from a female asking if I have found a title for my book. title? To be sure. Lovely lesbians. Your anecdotal life. A phrase of Mr. Borowski's. It is on Wednesdays that I have lunch with Borowski. His wife, who is a dried-up cow, officiates. She is studying English now. Her favorite word is filthy. You can see immediately what a pain in the ass the Borowskis are. But wait. Borowski wears corduroy suits and plays the accordion. An invincible combination, especially when you consider that he is not a bad artist. He puts on that he is a Pole, but he is not, of course. He is a Jew, Borowski, and his father was a philatelist. In fact, almost all Montparnasse is Jewish or half-Jewish, which is worse. There's Karl and Paula, and Kronstadt and Boris, and Tanya and Sylvester, and Maldorf and Lucille. All except Fillmore. Henry Jordan Oswald turned out to be a Jew also. Louis Nichols is a Jew. Even Van Norden and Chéri are Jewish. Francis Blake is a Jew, or a Jewess. Titus is a Jew. The Jews, then, are snowing me under. I am writing this for my friend Karl, whose father is a Jew. All this is important to understand. Of them all, the loveliest Jew is Tanya. And for her sake, I too would become a Jew. Why not? I already speak like a Jew, and I am as ugly as a Jew. Besides, who hates the Jews more than the Jew? Twilight hour. Indian blue, water of glass, trees glistening and liquescent. The rails fall away into the canal at Joris. A long caterpillar with lacquered sides dips like a roller coaster. It is not Paris. It is not Coney Island. It is a crepuscular mélange of all the cities of Europe and Central America. The railroad yards below me, the tracks black, webby, not ordered by the engineer, but cataclysmic in design, like those gaunt fissures in the polar ice which the camera registers in degrees of black. Food is one of the things I enjoy tremendously, and in this beautiful Villa Borghese, there is scarcely ever any evidence of food. It is positively appalling at times. I have asked Boris time and again to order bread for breakfast, but he always forgets. He goes out for breakfast, it seems, and when he comes back, he is picking his teeth, and there is a little egg hanging from his goatee. He eats in the restaurant out of consideration for me. He says it hurts to eat a big meal and have me watch him. I like Van Norden, but I do not share his opinion of himself. I do not agree, for instance, that he is a philosopher or a thinker. He is cunt-struck, that's all, and he will never be a writer. Nor will Sylvester ever be a writer, though his name blaze in 50,000 candle-power red lights. The only writers about me for whom I have any respect at present are Karl and Boris. They are possessed. They glow inwardly with a white flame. They are mad and tone-deaf. They are sufferers. Maldorf, on the other hand, who suffers too in his peculiar way, is not mad. Maldorf is word drunk. He has no veins or blood vessels, no heart or kidneys. He is a portable trunk filled with innumerable drawers, and in the drawers are labels written out in white ink, brown ink, red ink, blue ink, vermilion, saffron, mauve, sienna, apricot, turquoise, onyx, Anjou, herring, corona, verdigris, gorgonzola. I have moved the typewriter into the next room, where I can see myself in the mirror as I write. Tanya is like Irene. She expects fat letters. But there is another Tanya. A Tanya like a big seed who scatters pollen everywhere. Or let us say, a little bit of Tolstoy, a stable scene in which the fetus is dug up. Tanya is a fever, too. Les voies urinaires, Café de la Liberté, Place des Vosges. bright neckties on the Boulevard Montparnasse, dark bathrooms, Porto Sec, Abdullah's cigarettes, the Adagio Sonata Pathétique, oral amplificators, anecdotal seances, burnt sienna breasts, heavy garters. What time is it? Golden pheasants stuffed with chestnuts, taffeta fingers, vaporish twilights turning to ilex, acromegaly, cancer and delirium, warm veils, poker chips, carpets of blood and soft thighs. Tanya says so that everyone may hear, I love him. And while Boris scalds himself with whiskey, she says, sit down here. Oh, Boris, Russia, what'll I do? I'm bursting with it. At night, when I look at Boris's goatee lying on the pillow, I get hysterical. Oh, Tanya, where now is that warm cunt of yours? Those fat, heavy garters, those soft, bulging thighs. There is a bone in my prick 6 inches long. I will ream out every wrinkle in your cunt, Tanya, big with seed. I will send you home to your Sylvester with an ache in your belly and your womb turned inside out. Your Sylvester. Yes, he knows how to build a fire, but I know how to inflame a cunt. I shoot hot bolts into you, Tanya. I make your ovaries incandescent. Your Sylvester is a little jealous now? He feels something, does he? He feels the remnants of my big prick. I have set the shores a little wider. I have ironed out the wrinkles. After me, you can take on stallions, bulls, rams, drakes, St. Bernards. You can stuff toads, bats, lizards up your rectum. You can shit arpeggios if you like, or string a zither across your navel. I am fucking you, Tanya, so that you'll stay fucked. And if you are afraid of being fucked publicly, I will fuck you privately. I will tear off a few hairs from your cunt and paste them on Boris's chin. I will bite into your clitoris and spit out 2 franc pieces. Indigo sky, swept clear of fleecy clouds, gaunt trees infinitely extended, their black boughs gesticulating like a sleepwalker. Somber, spectral trees, their trunks pale as cigar ash. A silence supreme and altogether European. Shutters drawn, shops barred, a red glow here and there to mark a tryst. Brusque the facades, almost forbidding, immaculate except for the splotches of shadow cast by the trees. Passing by the Orangerie, I am reminded of another Paris. The Paris of Mom, of Gauguin, Paris of George Moore. I think of the terrible Spaniard who was then startling the world with his acrobatic leaps from style to style. I think of Spengler and of his terrible pronunciamentos. And I wonder if style in the grand manner, is done for. I say that my mind is occupied with these thoughts, but it is not true. It is only later, after I have crossed the Seine, after I have put behind me the carnival of lights, that I allow my mind to play with these ideas. For the moment, I can think of nothing, except that I am a sentient being stabbed by the miracle of these waters that reflect a forgotten world. All along the banks, the trees lean heavily over the tarnished mirror. When the wind rises and fills them with a rustling murmur, they will shed a few tears and shiver as the water swirls by. I am suffocated by it. No one to whom I can communicate even a fraction of my feelings. The trouble with Irene is that she has a valise instead of a cunt. She wants fat lettuce to shove in her valise. Immense. Avec des choses ennuyées. Lona now. She had a cunt. I know because she sent us some hairs from down below. Lona, a wild ass snuffing pleasure out of the wind. On every high hill, she played the harlot, and sometimes in telephone booths and toilets. She bought a bed for King Carol and a shaving mug with his initials on it. She lay in Tottenham Court Road with a dress pulled up and fingered herself. She used candles, Roman candles, and doorknobs. Not a prick in the land big enough for her. Not one. Men went inside her and curled up. She wanted extension pricks, self-exploding rockets, hot boiling oil made of wax and creosote. She would cut off your prick and keep it inside her forever if you gave her permission. One cunt out of a million, Lona. A laboratory cunt and no litmus paper that could take her color. She was a liar, too, this Lona. She never bought a bed for her King Carol. She crowned him with a whiskey bottle, and her tongue was full of lice and tomorrows. Poor Carol, he could only curl up inside her and die. She drew a breath, and he fell out like a dead clam. Enormous, fat letters, avec des choses à nouer. A valise without straps, a hole without a key. She had a German mouth, French ears, Russian ass, cunt international. When the flag waved, it was red all the way back to the throat. You entered on the Boulevard Jules Ferry and came out at the Porte de la Villette. You dropped your sweetbreads into the tumbrils, red tumbrils with two wheels, naturally. At the confluence of the Ourcq and Marne, where the water sluices through the dikes and lies like glass under the bridges. Lona is lying there now, and the canal is full of glass and splinters. The mimosas weep, and there is a wet, foggy fart on the window panes. One cunt out of a million, Lona. All cunt and a glass ass in which you can read the history of the Middle Ages. It is the caricature of a man which Maldorf first presents. Thyroid eyes, Michelin lips, voice like pea soup. Under his vest, he carries a little pear. However you look at him, it is always the same panorama. Netsuki snuff box, ivory handle, chess piece, fan, temple motif. He has fermented so long now that he is amorphous. Yeast despoiled of its vitamins. Vase without a rubber plant. The females were sired twice in the 9th century and again during the Renaissance. He was carried through the great dispersions under yellow bellies and white. Long before the Exodus, a Tatar spat in his blood. His dilemma is that of the dwarf. With his pineal eye, he sees his silhouette projected on a screen of incommensurable size. His voice, synchronized to the shadow of a pinhead, intoxicates him. He hears a roar where others hear only a squeak. There is his mind. It is an amphitheater in which the actor gives a Protean performance. Maldorf, multiform and unerring, goes through his roles. Clown, juggler, contortionist, priest, lecher, mountebank. The amphitheater is too small. He puts dynamite to it. The audience is drugged. He scotches it. I am trying ineffectually to approach Maldorf. It is like trying to approach God, for Maldorf is God. He has never been anything else. I am merely putting down the words. I have had opinions about him which I have discarded. I have had other opinions which I am revising. I have pinned him down only to find that it was not a dung beetle I had in my hands, but a dragonfly. He has offended me by his coarseness and then overwhelmed me with his delicacy. He has been voluble to the point of suffocation, then quiet as the Jordan. When I see him trotting forward to greet me, his little paws outstretched, his eyes perspiring, I feel that I am meeting... No, this is not the way to go about it. Comme un œuf dansant sur un jet d'eau. He has only one cane, a mediocre one. In his pocket, scraps of paper containing prescriptions for Weltschmerz. He is cured now, and the little German girl who washed his feet is breaking her heart. It is like Mr. Nonentity toting his Gujarati dictionary everywhere. Inevitable for everyone, meaning, no doubt, indispensable. Borowski would find all this incomprehensible. Borowski has a different cane for each day in the week, and one for Easter. We have so many points in common that it is like looking at myself in a cracked mirror. I have been looking over my manuscripts, pages scrawled with revisions, pages of literature. This frightens me a little. It is so much like Maldorf. Only I am a Gentile, and Gentiles have a different way of suffering. They suffer without neuroses, and as Sylvester says, a man who has never been afflicted with a neurosis does not know the meaning of suffering. I recall distinctly how I enjoyed my suffering. It was like taking a cub to bed with you. Once in a while he clawed you, and then you really were frightened. Ordinarily, you had no fear. You could always turn him loose or chop his head off. There are people who cannot resist the desire to get into a cage with wild beasts and be mangled. They go in even without revolver or whip. Fear makes them fearless. For the Jew, the world is a cage filled with wild beasts. The door is locked, and he is there without whip or revolver. His courage is so great that he does not even smell the dung in the corner. The spectators applaud, but he does not hear. The drama, he thinks, is going on inside the cage. The cage, he thinks, is the world. Standing there, alone and helpless, the door locked, he finds that the lions do not understand his language. Not one lion has ever heard of Spinoza. Spinoza? Why, they can't even get their teeth into him. Give us meat, they roar, while he stands there petrified, his ideas frozen, his Weltanschauung a trapeze out of reach. A single blow of the lion's paw, and his cosmogony is smashed. The lions, too, are disappointed. They expected blood, bones, gristle, sinews. They chew and chew, but the words are chicle, and chicle is indigestible. Chicle is a base over which you sprinkle sugar, pepsin, thyme, licorice. Chicle, when it is gathered by chicleros, is okay. The chicleros came over on the ridge of a sunken continent. They brought with them an algebraic language. In the Arizona desert, they met the Mongols of the north, glazed like eggplants. Time shortly after the earth had taken its gyroscopic lean, when the Gulf Stream was parting ways with the Japanese current. In the heart of the soil, they found tufa rock. They embroidered the very bowels of the earth with their language. They ate one another's entrails, and the forest closed in on them, on their bones and skulls, on their lace tufa. Their language was lost. Here and there, one still finds the remnants of a menagerie, a brain plate covered with figures. What has all this to do with you, Maldorf? The word in your mouth is anarchy. Say it, Maldorf. I am waiting for it. Nobody knows when we shake hands the rivers that pour through our sweat. Whilst you are framing your words, your lips half parted, the saliva gurgling in your cheeks, I have jumped halfway across Asia. Were I to take your cane, mediocre as it is, and poke a little hole in your side, I could collect enough material to fill the British Museum. We stand on 5 minutes and devour centuries. You are the sieve through which my anarchy strains, resolves itself into words. Behind the word is chaos, each word a stripe, a bar. But there are not and never will be enough bars to make the mesh. In my absence, the window curtains have been hung. They have the appearance of Tyrolean tablecloths dipped in Lysol. The room sparkles. I sit on the bed in a daze, thinking about man before his birth. Suddenly, bells begin to toll, a weird, unearthly music, as if I had been transplanted to the steppes of Central Asia. Some ring out with a long, lingering roll. Some erupt drunkenly, maudlinly. And now it is quiet again, except for a last note that barely grazes the silence of the night, just a faint, high gong, snuffed out like a flame. I have made a silent compact with myself not to change a line of what I write. I am not interested in perfecting my thoughts nor my actions. Beside the perfection of Turgenev, I put the perfection of Dostoevsky. Is there anything more perfect than the eternal husband? Here, then, in one and the same medium, we have two kinds of perfection. But in Van Gogh's letters, there is perfection beyond either of these. It is the triumph of the individual over art. There is only one thing which interests me vitally now, and that is the recording of all that which is omitted in books. Nobody, so far as I can see, is making use of those elements in the air which gives direction and motivation to our lives. Only the killers seem to be extracting from life some satisfactory measure of what they are putting into it. The age demands violence, but we are getting only abortive explosions. Revolutions are nipped in the bud, or else succeed too quickly. Passion is quickly exhausted. Men fall back on ideas, comme d'habitude. Nothing is proposed that can last more than 24 hours. We are living a million lives in the space of a generation. In the study of entomology, or of deep-sea life, or cellular activity, we derive more... The telephone interrupts this thought, which I should never have been able to complete. Someone is coming to rent the apartment. It looks as though it were finished, my life at the Villa Borghese. Well, I'll take up these pages and move on. Things will happen elsewhere. Things are always happening. It seems wherever I go, there is drama. People are like lice. They get under your skin and bury themselves there. You scratch and scratch until the blood comes, but you can't get permanently deloused. Everywhere I go, people are making a mess of their lives. Everyone has his private tragedy. It's in the blood now. Misfortune, ennui, grief, suicide. The atmosphere is saturated with disaster, frustration, futility. Scratch and scratch until there's no skin left. However, the effect upon me is exhilarating. Instead of being discouraged or depressed, I enjoy it. I am crying for more and more disasters, for bigger calamities, for grander failures. I want the whole world to be out of whack. I want everyone to scratch himself to death. So fast and furiously am I compelled to live now that there is scarcely time to record even these fragmentary notes. After the telephone call, a gentleman and his wife arrived. I went upstairs to lie down during the transaction, lay there wondering what my next move would be. Surely not to go back to the fairy's bed and toss about all night flicking breadcrumbs with my toes, that puking little bastard. If there's anything worse than being a fairy, it's being a miser. A timid, quaking little bugger who lives in constant fear of going broke someday. The 18th of March, perhaps, or the 25th of May, precisely. Coffee without milk or sugar, bread without butter, meat without gravy or no meat at all. Without this and without that, the dirty little miser. Open the bureau drawer one day and find money hidden away in a sock. Over 2,000 francs and checks that he hadn't even cashed. Even that I wouldn't have minded so much if there weren't always coffee grounds in my beret and garbage on the floor, to say nothing of the cold cream jars and the greasy towels and the sink always stopped up. I tell you, the little bastard, he smelled bad, except when he doused himself with cologne. His ears were dirty, his eyes were dirty, his ass was dirty. He was double-jointed, asthmatic, lousy, picayune, morbid. I could have forgiven him everything if only he had handed me a decent breakfast. But a man who has 2,000 francs hidden away in a dirty sock and refuses to wear a clean shirt or smear a little butter over his bread, such a man is not just a fairy, not even just a miser. He's an imbecile. But that's neither here nor there about the fairy. I'm keeping an ear open as to what's going on downstairs. It's a Mr. Wren and his wife who have called to look at the apartment. They're talking about taking it. Only talking about it, thank God. Mrs. Wren has a loose laugh. Complications ahead. Now Mr. Wren is talking. His voice is raucous, scraping, booming, a heavy, blunt weapon that wedges its way through flesh and bone and cartilage. Boris calls me down to be introduced. He is rubbing his hands like a pawnbroker. They are talking about a story Mr. Wren wrote, a story about a spavined horse. But I thought Mr. Wren was a painter. To be sure, says Boris, with a twinkle in his eye. But in the winter time he writes, and he writes well, remarkably well. I try to induce Mr. Wren to talk, to say something, anything, to talk about the spavined horse if necessary. But Mr. Wren is almost inarticulate. When he essays to speak of those dreary months with the pen, he becomes unintelligible. Months and months he spends before setting a word to paper. And there are only 3 months of winter. What does he cogitate all those months and months of winter? So help me God, I can't see this guy as a writer. Yet Mrs. Wren says that when he sits down to it, the stuff just pours out. The talk drifts. It is difficult to follow Mr. Wren's mind because he says nothing. He thinks as he goes along, so Mrs. Wren puts it. Mrs. Wren puts everything about Mr. Wren in the loveliest light. He thinks as he goes along. Very charming. Charming indeed, as Borowski would say, but really very painful, particularly when the thinker is nothing but a spavined horse. Boris hands me money to buy liquor. Going for the liquor, I am already intoxicated. I know just how I'll begin when I get back to the house. Walking down the street, it commences, the grand speech inside me that's gurgling like Mrs. Wren's loose laugh. Seems to me she had a slight edge on already. Listens beautifully when she's tight. Coming out of the wine shop, I hear the urinal gurgling. Everything is loose and splashy. I want Mrs. Wren to listen. Boris is rubbing his hands again. Mr. Wren is still stuttering and spluttering. I have a bottle between my legs, and I'm shoving the corkscrew in. Mrs. Wren has her mouth parted expectantly. The wine is splashing between my legs. The sun is splashing through the bay window. And inside my veins there is a bubble and splash of 1,000 crazy things that commence to gush out of me now, pell-mell. I'm telling them everything that comes to mind, everything that was bottled up inside me and which Mrs. Wren's loose laugh has somehow released. With that bottle between my legs and the sun splashing through the window, I experience once again the splendor of those miserable days when I first arrived in Paris, a bewildered, poverty-stricken individual who haunted the streets like a ghost at a banquet. Everything comes back to me in a rush. The toilets that wouldn't work. The prince who shined my shoes, the cinema splendide where I slept on the patron's overcoat, the bars in the window, the feeling of suffocation, the fat cockroaches, the drinking and carousing that went on between times, Rose Canac and Naples dying in the sunlight, dancing the streets on an empty belly and now and then calling on strange people. Madame Delorme, for instance. How I ever got to Madame Delorme's, I can't imagine anymore. But I got there, got inside somehow, past the butler, past the maid with her little white apron, got right inside the palace with my corduroy trousers and my hunting jacket, and not a button on my fly. Even now I can taste again the golden ambience of that room where Madame Delorme sat upon a throne in her mannish rig, the goldfish in the bowls, the maps of the ancient world, the beautifully bound books. I can feel again her heavy hand resting upon my shoulder, frightening me a little with her heavy lesbian air. More comfortable down below in that thick stew pouring into the Gare Saint-Lazare. The horrors in the doorways, seltzer bottles on every table, a thick tide of semen flooding the gutters. Nothing better between 5 and 7 than to be pushed around in that throng, to follow a leg or a beautiful bust, to move along with the tide and everything whirling in your brain. A weird sort of contentment in those days. No appointments, no invitations for dinner, no program, no dough. The golden period, when I had not a single friend. Each morning, the dreary walk to the American Express, and each morning, the inevitable answer from the clerk, dashing here and there like a bedbug, gathering butts now and then, sometimes furtively, sometimes brazenly, sitting down on a bench and squeezing my guts to stop the gnawing, or walking through the Jardin des Tuileries and getting an erection looking at the dumb statues, or wandering along the Seine at night, wandering and wandering, and going mad with the beauty of it, the trees leaning too, the broken images in the water, the rush of the current under the bloody lights of the bridges, the women sleeping in doorways, sleeping on newspapers, sleeping in the rain. Everywhere, the musty porches of the cathedrals and beggars and lice and old hags full of St. Vitus dance, push carts stacked up like wine barrels in the side streets, the smell of berries in the marketplace and the old church surrounded with vegetables and blue arc lights, the gutters slippery with garbage, and women in satin pumps staggering through the filth and vermin at the end of an all-night souse. The Place Saint-Sulpice, so quiet and deserted, where toward midnight there came every night the woman with the busted umbrella and the crazy veil. Every night she slept there on a bench under her torn umbrella, the ribs hanging down, her dress turning green, her bony fingers and the odor of decay oozing from her body. And in the morning I'd be sitting there myself, taking a quiet snooze in the sunshine, cursing the goddamn pigeons gathering up the crumbs everywhere. Saint-Sulpice, the fat belfries, the garish posters over the door, the candles flaming inside, the square so beloved of Anatole France, with that drone and buzz from the altar, the splash of the fountain, the pigeons cooing, the crumbs disappearing like magic, and only a dull rumbling in the hollow of the guts. Here I would sit day after day thinking of Germaine and that dirty little street near the Bastille where she lived, and that buzz-buzz going on behind the altar, the buses whizzing by, the sun beating down into the asphalt, and the asphalt working into me and Germaine, into the asphalt, and all Paris and the big, fat belfries. And it was down the Rue Bonaparte that only a year before, Mona and I used to walk every night, after we had taken leave of Borowski. Saint-Sulpice not meaning much to me then, nor anything in Paris. Washed out with talk, sick of faces, fed up with cathedrals and squares and menageries and whatnot, picking up a book in the red bedroom and the cane chair uncomfortable, tired of sitting on my ass all day long, tired of red wallpaper, tired of seeing so many people jabbering away about nothing. The red bedroom and the trunk always open, her gowns lying about in a delirium of disorder. The red bedroom with my galoshes and canes, the notebooks I never touched, the manuscripts lying cold and dead. Paris, meaning the Café Select, the Dome, the Flea Market, the American Express. Paris, meaning Borowski's canes, Borowski's hats, Borowski's gouache, Borowski's prehistoric fish and prehistoric jokes. In that Paris of 28, only one night stands out in my memory. The night before sailing for America. A rare night, with Borowski slightly pickled and a little disgusted with me because I'm dancing with every slut in the place. But we're leaving in the morning. That's what I tell every cunt I grab hold of. Leaving in the morning. That's what I'm telling the blonde with agate-colored eyes. And while I'm telling her, she takes my hand and squeezes it between her legs. In the lavatory, I stand before the ball with a tremendous erection. It seems light and heavy at the same time, like a piece of lead with wings on it. And while I'm standing there like that, two cunts sail in, Americans. I greet them cordially, prick in hand. They give me a wink and pass on. In the vestibule, as I'm buttoning my fly, I notice one of them waiting for her friend to come out of the can. The music is still playing, and maybe Mona will be coming to fetch me, or Borowski with his gold-knobbed cane. But I'm in her arms now, and she has hold of me, and I don't care who comes or what happens. We wriggle into the cabinet, and there I stand her up, slap up against the wall, and I try to get it into her, but it won't work. And so we sit down on the seat and try it that way, but it won't work either. No matter how we try, it won't work. And all the while she's got hold of my prick. She's clutching it like a lifesaver. But it's no use. We're too hot, too eager. The music is still playing, and so we waltz out of the cabinet into the vestibule again. And as we're dancing there in the shithouse, I come all over her beautiful gown, and she's sore as hell about it. I stumble back to the table, and there's Borowski with his ruddy face, and Mona with her disapproving eye. And Borowski says, "Let's all go to Brussels tomorrow." And we agree. And when we get back to the hotel, I vomit all over the place, in the bed, in the washbowl, over the suits and gowns and the galoshes and canes and the notebooks I never touched and the manuscripts, cold and dead. End of Side One. Side Two. A few months later, the same hotel, the same room. We look out on the courtyard where the bicycles are parked, and there is the little room up above, under the attic, where some smart young Alec played the phonograph all day long and repeated clever little things at the top of his voice. I say we, but I'm getting ahead of myself, because Mona has been away a long time. And it's just today that I'm meeting her at the Gare Saint-Lazare. Toward evening, I'm standing there with my face squeezed between the bars. But there's no Mona. And I read the cable over again, but it doesn't help any. I go back to the quarter, and just the same, I put away a hearty meal. Strolling past the dome a little later, suddenly I see a pale, heavy face and burning eyes, and the little velvet suit that I always adore, because under the soft velvet, there were always her warm breasts, the marble legs, cool, firm, muscular. She rises up out of a sea of faces and embraces me passionately. 1,000 eyes, noses, fingers, legs, bottles, windows, purses, saucers, all glaring at us, and we in each other's arms oblivious. I sit down beside her, and she talks, a flood of talk. Wild, consumptive notes of hysteria, perversion, leprosy. I hear not a word because she is beautiful and I love her, and now I am happy and willing to die. We walk down the Rue du Château looking for Eugene, walk over the railroad bridge where I used to watch the trains pulling out and feel all sick inside, wondering where the hell she could be. Everything's soft and enchanting as we walk over the bridge. smoke coming up between our legs, the tracks creaking, semaphores in our blood. I could feel her body close to mine, all mine now, and I stopped to rub my hands over the warm velvet. Everything around us is crumbling, crumbling, and the warm body under the warm velvet is aching for me. Back in the very same room and 50 francs to the good, thanks to Eugene, I look out on the court, but the phonograph is silent. The trunk is open, and her things are lying around everywhere, just as before. She lies down on the bed with her clothes on. Once, twice, three times, four times. I'm afraid she'll go mad. In bed, under the blankets, how good to feel her body again. But for how long? Will it last this time? Already I have a presentiment that it won't. She talks to me so feverishly, as if there will be no tomorrow. Be quiet, Mona. Just look at me. Don't talk. Finally, she drops off, and I pull my arm from under her. My eyes close. Her body is there beside me. It will be there till morning, surely. It was in February I pulled out of the harbor in a blinding snowstorm. The last glimpse I had of her was in the window, waving goodbye to me. A man standing on the other side of the street, at the corner, his hat pulled down over his eyes, his jowls resting on his lapels. A fetus watching me. A fetus with a cigar in its mouth. Mona at the window, waving goodbye. White, heavy face, hair streaming wild. And now it is a heavy bedroom, breathing regularly through the gills, sap still oozing from between her legs. A warm feline odor, and her hair in my mouth. My eyes are closed. We breathe warmly into each other's mouth, close together. America 3,000 miles away. I never want to see it again. To have her here in bed with me, breathing on me, her hair in my mouth, I count that something of a miracle. Nothing can happen now till morning. I wake from a deep slumber to look at her. A pale light is trickling in. I look at her beautiful, wild hair. I feel something crawling down my neck. I look at her again, closely. Her hair is alive. I pull back the sheet. More of them. They are swarming over the pillow. It is a little after daybreak. We pack hurriedly and sneak out of the hotel. The cafes are still closed. We walk, and as we walk, we scratch ourselves. The day opens in milky whiteness, streaks of salmon pink sky, snails leaving their shells. Paris. Paris. Everything happens here. Old crumbling walls and the pleasant sound of water running in the urinals, men licking their mustaches at the bar, shutters going up with a bang, and little streams purling in the gutters. Anna Picon in huge scarlet letters, zigzag, which way will we go and why or where or what? Mona is hungry, her dress is thin. Nothing but evening wraps, bottles of perfume, barbaric earrings, bracelets, depilatories. We sit down in a billiard parlor on the Avenue du Maine and order hot coffee. The toilet is out of order. We shall have to sit some time before we can go to another hotel. Meanwhile, we pick bedbugs out of each other's hair. Nervous. Mona is losing her temper. Must have a bath. Must have this. Must have that. Must. How much money have you left? Money? Forgot all about that. Hotel des États-Unis. An ascenseur. We go to bed in broad daylight. When we get up, it is dark. And the first thing to do is to raise enough dough to send a cable to America. A cable to the fetus with a long, juicy cigar in his mouth. Meanwhile, there is the Spanish woman on the Boulevard Espai. She's always good for a warm meal. By morning, something will happen. At least we're going to bed together. No more bed bugs now. The rainy season has commenced. The sheets are immaculate. A new life opening up for me at the Villa Borghese. Only 10 o'clock, and we have already had breakfast and been out for a walk. We have an Elsa here with us now. Step softly for a few days, cautions Boris. The day begins gloriously. A bright sky, a fresh wind, the houses newly washed. On our way to the post office, Boris and I discussed the book. The last book, which is going to be written anonymously. A new day is beginning. I felt it this morning as we stood before one of Dufresne's glistening canvases. A sort of déjeuner intime in the 13th century, Saint-Vin. A fine, fleshy nude, solid, vibrant, pink as a fingernail, with glistening billows of flesh. All the secondary characteristics and a few of the primary. A body that sings, that has the moisture of dawn. A still life, only nothing is still, nothing dead here. The table creaks with food. It is so heavy it is sliding out of the frame. A 13th century repast, with all the jungle notes that he has memorized so well. A family of gazelles and zebras nipping the fronds of the palms. And now we have Elsa. She was playing for us this morning while we were in bed. Step softly for a few days. Good. Elsa is the maid, and I am the guest. And Boris is the big cheese. A new drama is beginning. I'm laughing to myself as I write this. He knows what is going to happen, that lynx Boris. He has a nose for things, too. Step softly. Boris is on pins and needles. At any moment now, his wife may appear on the scene. She weighs well over 180 pounds, that wife of his, and Boris is only a handful. There you have the situation. He tries to explain it to me on our way home at night. It is so tragic and so ridiculous at the same time that I am obliged to stop now and then and laugh in his face. "Why do you laugh so?" he says gently. And then he commences himself with that whimpering, hysterical note in his voice, like a helpless wretch who realizes suddenly that no matter how many frock coats he puts on, he will never make a man. He wants to run away, to take a new name. "She can have everything, that cow, if only she leaves me alone," he whines. But first, the apartment has to be rented and the deed signed, and 1,000 other details for which his frock coat will come in handy. But the size of her, that's what really worries him. If we were to find her suddenly standing on the doorstep when we arrive, he would faint. That's how much he respects her. And so we've got to go easy with Elsa for a while. Elsa is only there to make breakfast and to show the apartment. But Elsa is already undermining me. That German blood, those melancholy songs. Coming down the stairs this morning, with the fresh coffee in my nostrils, I was humming softly, "Es war so schön gewesen." For breakfast, that. And in a little while, the English boy upstairs with his Bach. As Elsa says, "He needs a woman." And Elsa needs something, too. I can feel it. I didn't say anything to Boris about it, but while he was cleaning his teeth this morning, Elsa was giving me an earful about Berlin, about the women who look so attractive from behind. And when they turn around, wow, syphilis. It seems to me that Elsa looks at me rather wistfully, something left over from the breakfast table. This afternoon, we were writing back to back in the studio. She had begun a letter to her lover who was in Italy. The machine got jammed. Boris had gone to look at a cheap room he will take as soon as the apartment is rented. There was nothing for it but to make love to Elsa. She wanted it. And yet I felt a little sorry for her. She had only written the first line to her lover. I read it out of the corner of my eye as I bent over her. But it couldn't be helped. That damned German music, so melancholy, so sentimental, it undermined me. And then her beady little eyes, so hot and sorrowful at the same time. After it was over, I asked her to play something for me. She's a musician, Elsa, even though it sounded like broken pots and skulls clanking. She was weeping, too, as she played. I don't blame her. Everywhere the same thing, she says. Everywhere a man, and then she has to leave. And then there's an abortion, and then a new job, and then another man, and Nobody gives a fuck about her except the user. All this after she's played Schumann for me. Schumann, that slobbery, sentimental German bastard. Somehow I feel sorry as hell for her, and yet I don't give a damn. A cunt who can play as she does ought to have better sense than be tripped up by every guy with a big putz who happens to come along. But that Schumann gets into my blood. She's still sniffling, Elsa, but my mind is far away. I'm thinking of Tanya and how she claws away at her adagio. I'm thinking of lots of things that are gone and buried. Thinking of a summer afternoon in Greenpoint when the Germans were romping over Belgium and we had not yet lost enough money to be concerned over the rape of a neutral country. A time when we were still innocent enough to listen to poets and to sit around a table in the twilight rapping for departed spirits. All that afternoon and evening, the atmosphere is saturated with German music. The whole neighborhood is German, more German even than Germany. We were brought up on Schumann and Hugo Wolf and sauerkraut and kümmel and potato dumplings. Toward evening, we're sitting around a big table with the curtains drawn, and some fool two-headed wench is rapping for Jesus Christ. We're holding fingers under the table, and the dame next to me has two fingers in my fly. And finally, we lie on the floor behind the piano while someone sings a dreary song. The air is stifling, and her breath is boozy. The pedal is moving up and down, stiffly, automatically, a crazy, futile movement, like a tower of dung that takes 27 years to build but keeps perfect time. I pull her over me with the sounding board in my ears. The room is dark and the carpet is sticky with the kümmel that has been spilled about. Suddenly, it seems as if the dawn were coming. It is like water purling over ice, and the ice is blue with a rising mist. Glaciers sunk in emerald green. Chamois and antelope, golden groupers, sea cows mooching along, and the amberjack leaping over the Arctic rim. Elsa is sitting in my lap. Her eyes are like little belly buttons. I look at her large mouth, so wet and glistening, and I cover it. She is humming now. Es war so schön gewesen. Ah, Elsa, you don't know yet what that means to me. Your Trompete von Sackingen, German singing societies, Schwabenhall, the Turnverein, linksum, rechtsum, and then a whack over the ass with the end of a rope. Ah, the Germans. They take you all over like an omnibus. They give you indigestion. In the same night, one cannot visit the morgue, the infirmary, the zoo, the signs of the zodiac, the limbos of philosophy, the caves of epistemology, the arcana of Freud and Steckel. On the merry-go-round, one doesn't get anywhere. Whereas with the Germans, one can go from Vega to Lope de Vega all in one night and come away as foolish as Parsifal. As I say, the day began gloriously. It was only this morning that I became conscious again of this physical Paris, of which I have been unaware for weeks. Perhaps it is because the book has begun to grow inside me. I am carrying it around with me everywhere. I walk through the streets big with child, and the cops escort me across the street. Women get up to offer me their seats. Nobody pushes me rudely anymore. I am pregnant. I waddle awkwardly, my big stomach pressed against the weight of the world. It was this morning, on our way to the post office, that we gave the book its final imprimatur. We have evolved a new cosmogony of literature, Boris and I. It is to be a new Bible. The last book. All those who have anything to say will say it here, anonymously. We will exhaust the age. After us, not another book, not for a generation at least. Heretofore, we had been digging in the dark, with nothing but instinct to guide us. Now we shall have a vessel in which to pour the vital fluid, a bomb which, when we throw it, will set off the world. We shall put into it enough to give the writers of tomorrow their plots, their dramas, their poems, their myths, their sciences. The world will be able to feed on it for 1,000 years to come. It is colossal in its pretentiousness. The thought of it almost shatters me. For 100 years or more, the world, our world, has been dying. and not one man in these last 100 years or so has been crazy enough to put a bomb up the asshole of creation and set it off. The world is rotting away, dying piecemeal, but it needs the coup de grace. It needs to be blown to smithereens. Not one of us is intact. And yet we have in us all the continents and the seas between the continents and the birds of the air. We are going to put it down. The evolution of this world, which has died but which has not been buried. We are swimming on the face of time.